On this week's 51%, we hear from a woman who writes about reproductive technology and who decided to become a single mother.
You know, the last frontier for women's rights is reproduction. I mean, I think I heard Gloria Steinem talk about that, you know, that is where you can see that the patriarchy exists.
Plus, how has the role of the First Lady evolved? I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Well, I hate to bring it up because I know you got enough pressure on you already, but we agreed to get married as soon as you won your first case. Meanwhile, 10 years later, my niece, the daughter of my sister, is getting married. My biological clock is ticking like this, and the way this case is going, I ain't never getting married.
That's Marissa Tomei's character in the 1992 film My Cousin Vinny. But the ticking biological clock women may hear nowadays is sounding at a time when there have been advances in medical science. Why should biology decide when or how you'll have a baby? KALW Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller speaks with writer and consultant Rachel Lehman Hote, who, as she investigated new reproductive technologies, was faced with her own ticking biological clock. Lehman Hote, author of In Her Own Sweet Time, Egg Freezing and the New Frontiers of Family, shares how she reached her decision to have a baby on her own as a single mom after turning 40. We'll pick up her story after she'd gotten out of a relationship and was headed for India, and in her late 30s. Just to note, there is a somewhat graphic description of artificial insemination.
I came back from India and I decided to get my eggs frozen. Even though I'd written all about it, I hadn't actually done it myself.
But you haven't used them, right?
Nope.
They're still sitting on ice somewhere.
They are.
But you have a child.
I do.
So tell us how that came to be.
Okay. Well, I mean, I actually talked to a couple of guy friends. One was an ex-boyfriend and talked about maybe doing co-parenting together. One guy, I just asked him if he would, you know, be my donor. And then this ex-boyfriend and I talked about how we were still really good friends and maybe it would be great if we just, you know, co-parent it. But, you know, ultimately I decided that it was my values. I mean, and this is not everybody's values and I'm not placing any judgment, but that, you know, if I was going to have a child on my own, that I wanted to use a donor that there wasn't a father in the picture, that it was a biological father and that was it. And because I wanted to leave that space open for there to potential for that child to have a social father. And I felt like if I had co-parented, any man that I met down the road would end up sort of playing more the role of a step than anything else. So I kind of wanted to, you know, have my family just be me and my kid, so that space was opened for a man to come into. So that's ultimately what I decided to do.
What were you looking for as you tried to decide who the magic sperm was going to come from?
So I feel like I always have to think about my son now because he, you know, will hear these. I knew that I wanted to have a baby. I knew that I needed a man part. And so what I did was I, you know, went to a nonprofit sperm bank and looked in their catalog. And the most important thing was that I knew that my child would want to know about this man one day. So I chose this kind of program called Open Identity, where the man has no legal connection to the child, but the child would be able to meet him someday to learn. So that's what I did. And the criteria I used was, a lot of it was just gut. I read a lot of profiles. It was kind of like online dating. I, you know, thought about my own values. I thought about that I wanted, you know, a guy that maybe shared some of my same ethnic background. So I could, you know, one day point to a map with my child and say, hey, you know, we're all from here. And I ultimately just read a lot of essays. And the guy I ended up picking, who was a science and genetics expert and also happened to be a professional poker player.
Nice.
And I don't know, there was something about that and the fact that he was, I mean, I remember my dad once, I was telling my dad about it once, and he was like, you know, poker players are really smart.
Oh,
you
yeah.
You got to be smart to be a professional poker player. So I knew that, you know, the guy would be smart. And there was just something about his essay that really made me feel like he wasn't donating for the money. He really understood why a woman or a family who has infertility would need a sperm donor. And it just made me feel at peace. And he was funny.
In the writing.
In the writing,
because you've never met him.
No, never met him.
So
never.
You might meet him when your son is 18.
Possibly,
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, well, mark your calendar.
Exactly.
You're coming back here.
But that's really up. That's really going to be up to my son.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did you make this baby?
Okay.
Now we're going to read from In Her Own Sweet Time. This is in the DIY.
This is in a chapter called DIY Mom.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I started thinking about what a mentor once said about New York and the Bay Area. New York is about power, who's up and who's down, while the Bay Area is about new ideas. He was comparing the city's world of establishment finance and media to the disruptive do-it-yourself culture of technologists tinkering in Silicon Valley garages. I've always been fascinated by Northern California's counterculture. My uncles had both moved here in the 1960s to be part of Ken Kesey's experimental psychedelic scene on Perry Lane in Menlo Park. And later, Uncle Sandy, a sound engineer, joined Kesey's band of merry pranksters for their cross-country bus trip to shake up post-World War II America. I realized that I liked being in a place that had not only inspired this counterculture, but also the current DIY movement of tool-building geeks and crafters. Ultimately, I decide to embrace the culture around me and take the means of production into my own hands. I even decide that rather than getting inseminated in a sterile doctor's office, I'll have a midwife help me do it by myself at home on my houseboat. So on October 24th, I start trying. It had been pouring rain in Sausalito for 2 days, the kind of rain that hits the water sideways, sending furious ripples across the surface. My houseboat rattles in the wind, and the sailboats in the marina next door are clanging and flapping with such wild force that they keep me up half the night. I'm startled when Rebecca, a doe-eyed midwife from Point Reyes Station, knocks on the door early in the morning, stomping her boots and brushing water off her face. I called her the night before to tell her that I was ovulating, that she needed to come over to get me pregnant as soon as possible, but I didn't think she'd make it through the storm. Good morning, she says, stepping inside, as if the weather was an aside. Shall we begin unfreezing your vial? Rebecca opens the canister as a thick plume of dry ice spills over the top, as if this were a mad science experiment. She pulls out two tiny vials and transfers them into a warm cloth. She tells me to lie down on the couch as she rubs the vials between her hands. After a few minutes of thawing, she softly pushes apart my legs and inserts a speculum. How romantic, I say, half smiling. She giggles, trying not to lose her professional manner. She then takes out a long syringe, places it inside the now warm vial, and sucks the specimen up into it. Okay, take a deep breath, she says, as she places it inside me. A gust of wind sweeps through the marina, and the boat quivers. Auspicious, she says. Then that's it. She tells me to lie still for about a half an hour and then go about my day as usual. You'll know you're pregnant intuitively, she says, but if you don't, take a pregnancy test in about 2 weeks. Now it was up to nature. I lie back and look around my new home, decorate it with turquoise pillows, blue sea glass, coral candle holders, and sand-colored walls, a virtual sea nest. Whether or not this insemination works this first try, I finally made a decision to push my life into a new stage. It's not the romantic dream I had imagined all my life of making a child with a man I love, but having come to trust myself to move forward on my own towards motherhood feels in a way even more powerful. When Rebecca leaves that morning, I feel elated.
So, did it work that time?
It didn't work that time. It actually took a year.
So finally you're pregnant. You're on your way to having a child, which you obviously did. He's now 5 years old. So now we get back into the whole question of work-life balance.
Yes.
You know, how do we juggle it all? Like this drive to have a baby, you know, another human living in your life by yourself.
Correct. On a houseboat.
On a houseboat. Are you still in the houseboat?
No.
Okay. And you, like, from what I understand, surfing, lots of travel, you know, pretty active life that didn't necessarily have a lot of room for another little creature in it, such as a baby. So what kinds of adjustments did you have to make in order to make that work? And also just acknowledging, like, single motherhood is something that's really hard, you know, whether it's by choice or not.
Yeah. It's not one of those things where you get pregnant or you give birth and you're suddenly like, I have to radically change my life, you know? It actually is a very slow change. And, you know, part of it I fought and I felt sad about, you know, especially giving up the travel because I love to travel. And, you know, I would take off to Argentina or India or somewhere, especially when I was reporting my book at a moment's notice, and clearly couldn't do that anymore. And then also, you know, there is the big issue of childcare and money. Because suddenly, you know, I lived, you know, pretty lean and mean as a freelance writer and, you know, could kind of be pretty scrappy. And suddenly, you know, I had to figure out how to pay for childcare, and I, you know, had to figure out how to pay for diapers, and I had to figure out how to pay for another human being's preschool. And one of the things I also really felt like I wanted was flexibility. And I think that that is possibly the most important thing for a mother in general, particularly a single mother by choice. One of my really good friends, Tiffany Schlein, the filmmaker.
She's been on the show. We talked about egg freezing.
You did. And she started, you know, this day, 50-50 day. She did this film, 50-50, and started this day, 50-50 day. And Tiffany has always talked about this idea of, you know, for women really to be able to have it all or do what they want to do or make things for the world is that you have to own your own time. And I believe I even had conversations with her around that, in which, you know, I really wanted to figure out a way. I had always owned my own time, but I kind of needed to own my own time and make a little bit more money to be able to afford the things that I now needed to afford. So what I did was kind of took a hiatus from writing books and decided to start my own company. And that happened really slowly. But I started a company called StoryMade Studios, where I looked around, and I looked around that I was, you know, in the Bay Area, and there were a lot of science, bioscience companies and tech companies, and I had this subject expertise as a, you know, expert in reproductive medicine, and have written about health a lot throughout my career, and have written about science, particularly, you know, science that affects women's lives. Throughout my career. So I realized that, you know, one of the things that that many of these companies needed was storytelling. And so I basically launched something, what I call it, a boutique storytelling studio. And what StoryMade has let me do is have clients and own my own time and have more diversified incomes and be able to charge hourly. And, you know, so I can go pick up, I'm not locked into a 9-to-5 job, and I can go pick up my son at school, and I'm not locked into being a journalist that makes a dollar a word, which is not as much money. So StoryMade, you know, has a particular expertise in reproductive science companies, and that really changed the game for me. I still am working on a new book, but, you know, now I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning when Alexander's asleep and write my morning pages, and the days are spent with clients writing and editing and producing that dreaded word, content.
So how do you talk to Alex about who his – does he ask who his dad is or where he came from? Like, how do you even answer the question – where did I come from?
You know, it's funny. I mean, the question actually has not come up. My friend, the novelist Holly Payne, came up with a great phrase. She calls donor dad, she says, his DD.
Uh-huh.
So I sometimes use the word your DD. And, you know, he knows he doesn't have a dad. He knows that our family is different from other families, from kids he goes to preschool with that do have dads. But quite frankly, you know, we don't really talk about it that much. It doesn't dominate. And I think that's very interesting because, I mean, my theory is, and maybe this is because he's younger or it might become more dominant later, is that he doesn't know anything else. This is his life. We project some idea that the nuclear family with a mom and a dad and two kids is the ideal. And I think the fact is that the nuclear family, the traditional nuclear family, is now 25% of the country. Families look very different than they did, and they never really looked that way. But also, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that he has incredible role models. I mean, he has the most incredible relationship with his grandfather. He has a male teacher at his school named Craig who teaches him to build things and teaches him to play guitar. And he has the most wonderful relationship with. And I have a brother who's his uncle who he has a wonderful relationship with. So there is not a lack of men in his life.
Well, one of the questions that I've been thinking about is, you know, with so much focus on making children being on the women, what did you learn or what have you heard from the male side of the equation? I mean, is this just totally messing with the guy's sense of what their role is in all this? Like, do we still need them?
Do we still need them?
I mean, yes. I personally feel we do.
But I feel we really do. We really need them. I mean, I really, really would like to, you know, have a partner and a man someday.
But in terms of, like, gender roles, what do you think this means for that?
No, I mean, I think it really is radically changing gender roles in a big way. I mean, you can just look towards the idea that the two-parent family, whether it's two men, two women, a man and a woman, really in this day and age needs two incomes to survive, especially in places like San Francisco or, you know, most metropolitan cities that are more expensive. So that automatically means that women are having children later or, you know, guys are having children later. Everybody's having children later. And that means that we all are investing in our careers and trying to build our bank accounts before we have kids. So I think, you know, obviously reproductive technologies like egg freezing, you know, I mean, I think Sheryl Sandberg, when she declared that they were going to cover it at Facebook, you know, really saw that this was a tool for women to postpone their fertility. I mean, again, a lot of people also argue, you know, it's a way to keep women in the workforce. And I do actually think that, you know, there is an argument. I don't think it's that draconian, but, you know, I definitely feel like we do not have enough support, you know, in terms of in-house daycare at companies and flexibility and all the things that women and men need to be good parents and to be able to kind of toggle between world. I mean, technology lets us toggle between home and the office so much now. You know, we can telecommute, we can work from home.
Yeah. So, but I'm also thinking, who knows where we're going to end up from a healthcare coverage standpoint in the current climate, right? And more to the point, how much control women will legally have over their own choices for reproduction.
Right. And you know, quite frankly, like, I mean, you know, it is a luxury product. Infertility is probably, you know, I mean, we're still at a point where, you know, we can't even get birth control pills. You know, the last frontier for women's rights is reproduction. I mean, I think I heard Gloria Steinem talk about that, you know, that is where you can see that the patriarchy exists, is when they grip and try to control women's reproduction. And that goes across the spectrum of, you know, the most important things like, you know, birth control and you know, giving women the power to not have children. But it also is things like egg freezing or other reproductive that gives them the power to put the pause button on their fertility and turn it on when they want to use it.
That was Rachel Lehman Hote, author of In Her Own Sweet Time, Egg Freezing and the New Frontiers of Family. Her other book is DIY Mom, a Solo Parenting Adventure. She also is founder and director of the Art and Science of Family Project that tells stories to raise awareness about new advanced reproductive technology and science. Lehman Hote was speaking with Lauren Schiller, host of Inflection Point, produced at KALW in San Francisco. The First Lady carries a lot of responsibility, but the role is really more custom than law. Susan Swain is co-CEO of C-SPAN. She was the host of their year-long series, First Ladies, Influence and Image, and editor of the accompanying book. Virginia Prescott, for a Civics 101 series, asked Swain about the role of the First Lady.
Well, it has changed over the course of time as the role of women in society has changed, as our media culture has grown, and also in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st, there's obviously been a great advantage to interested first ladies in using the tools available to them to advance the family business, the husband's political career. We don't pay them, obviously, for the work that they do, but they do have quite a bit of tools available. In Michelle Obama's case, she built the office up to a staff of 24 people with a budget of $1.25 million a year.
But at first, the first lady was a hostess, you know, managing social life in D.C. We think of Dolly Madison serving ice cream at the White House. Tell us a little bit more about that role in the early days. Were some of them able to be more than hostesses?
Well, I look at them in sort of periods. Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, Dolly Madison were of the generation of revolutionary women, and they, by their nature, were political because the country was going through an enormous founding period, and they were very much part of that process as they could be in the women's sphere at that time. We then went into a period when the country was established where the domestic role became really much more important after Jackson for a while, really up until the end of the century, except for, of course, during the war and Abraham Lincoln. But women were expected to stay in the domestic sphere. Congress was more ascendant in many of these presidencies than the White House was. Then at the beginning of the 20th century, we have Theodore Roosevelt coming in. We have a big rise in competitive newspapers and a great deal of interest in what was happening. And they had a very photogenic family in the White House, lots of kids bustling around, and there was enormous interest. And it really has continued to build since then, with both interest in the White House and presidents and first ladies using that to their best advantage politically.
So you have the dawn, I guess, of the celebrity first lady at that time. Who are the women who really defined the more modern image of the first lady?
The Lady Bird Johnson. Lady Bird really began to make the change into the modern first lady. Enormously political, was a very big political advisor and helpmate to Lyndon Johnson. There's some wonderful audio clips in the White House tapes that Lyndon Johnson made of her coaching him before and after speeches. She could say things to him that no one else around him could. And she also kept a diary of her time in the White House and was enormously influential in conservation issues and in the Head Start issue, getting preschool education for young children. We really began to think about every first lady having an issue from that point forward. Rosalind Carter, mental health, Nancy Reagan saying no to drugs. Hillary Clinton had a number of policy agendas, most notably, of course, healthcare issues. And from that point on, every first lady was really expected to have a signature issue that she advanced during her years in the White House.
What do we learn about American history when we learn more about its first ladies?
Well, it's a window into the presidencies in the White House, but it's also, throughout history, a great mark of the changing role of women in American society. Always they came from the more privileged class, but you really can see the role of women grow and change over time by looking at the women who occupied this role in American history.
Susan, you spent a year thinking and learning about these women. This is something that fascinates you. Would you want to be a first lady yourself?
Never.
Why not?
Never. I really would. I misstep a lot, I'm sure. I really imagine representing the entire United States or being a visible representation of a presidency. I just wouldn't like to have to look over my shoulder all the time like that and worry about every little bit. The advantages, of course, are a chance to do good about issues that matter to you, but it's a big trade-off.
That was Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's First Ladies Influence and Image series, editor of its book by the same title, and editor of the lively At First Ladies Twitter feed.
Civics 101 is supported in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1499.